surprised, are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt, or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration. And it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere after fleeing Myanmar. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The inflation rate in Italy has been high for a while, breaking record after record. An increasing number of Italians are struggling to make ends meet, fearing that the cost of living pinch could soon turn into pain. The National Bureau of Statistics recently announced that the prices in the country rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in 37 years.
It is impossible to continue this way. Gas and electricity bills have more than doubled, and the cost of bread and milk is going mad. This is pure madness.
Italy's annual inflation rate in December dropped to 11.6%, down from 11.8% in November, but the cost of living crisis keeps biting businesses and households hard. High energy prices caused by energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war is the main factor contributing to this surge.
The immediate loss of this situation has been the collapse of purchasing power by over 10%, which translates to the net loss of one monthly payment for employed workers. People on low income wages, such as employees and workmen, which represents 90% of the labor force, are among those suffering the most.
Analysts believe that a combination of high inflation, rising interest rates, and a lack of fiscal support will push Italy and other EU economies into recession.
Month after month, life is becoming increasingly tough. My retirement payment went up 50 euros 2 months ago, but the cost of living has increased by 200 euros each month.
Life is more expensive for those who live on one income only. The cost of renting houses, buying clothes for our kids, food. I can't see how we'll be able to face all this.
With the aim to fight high inflation and put prices under control, the European Central Bank has raised interest rates. The move is likely to hamper the European economy further. Some ministers in the Italian government have strongly criticized the ECB over its aggressive monetary policy that they believe could raise the prospect of recession. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the new year 2023, there isn't much to cheer about, economically speaking. That is because the news is grim when it comes to the state of the world economy. And that is an understatement. The World Bank has made a big cut to its 2023 growth outlook, saying that the globe is perilously close to recession. This is while going into the new year, the world was suffering from massive inflation, like in the EU and the US, as examples. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the reasons behind this gloomy outlook, how we got to this in the first place, and whether there are any signs that the world economy will improve anytime soon. Joining us to discuss this is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, who joins us from London. Clive Menzies, welcome. So, you know, there's a barrage of bad news that's coming out, so it was worthy of us to try to explore that in this program. One of them is the World Bank making big cuts to its forecast, I guess, for 2023. The global growth outlook it has stated is perilously close to recession, where it slashes economy or growth outlook for the economy to 1.7% for 2023 from 3% projection that it had said. What do you think is going on here? I mean, what can we say about this?
Well, I think, good evening, and I think one should not be surprised by what's happening. What I find quite incredible is that anybody who follows the sort of the blow-by-blow accounts in the mainstream media doesn't seem to be able to stand back and look at the trajectory that we have been following. And this was predictable probably since the global financial crisis in 2008, primarily because of the responses thereto. And we were warning as long ago as 7 years ago that we were heading for a global economic collapse. And last summer, when the governor of the Bank of England was suggesting that they were going to adhere to their 2% inflation target, that seemed somewhat laughable. The primary mechanisms that are causing this crisis have been long standing. One is the excessive money supply. So there's been money supply or money printing by the central banks, the major central banks, ever since 2008, and that has accelerated in the last 3 years, since September 2019, specifically with the Fed. This whole false climate narrative that has been fabricated with the ESG diktat that all companies have to conform to is also a contributory factor because it's driven up energy costs. And I know that the World Bank cited Ukraine as being one of the factors in all of this, but actually it is nothing to do with Ukraine itself. It's to do with the sanctions. I was on a program in May 2022 where all of the commentators, including myself, were suggesting that the EU and primarily shot itself in the foot, but with America's encouragement, because it's the sanctions that has created this this acute problem that we have now. But having said all that, even without Ukraine war, we would still be in this mess because the trajectory has been driving us here through excess money and energy policies that make no sense and have no basis in reality because there is no climate crisis.
All right, so I jotted down some of the things that you were talking about, and I want to ask you about this one particular one that is mentioned time and again, and you have also mentioned that time and again, and that is the fact that is somewhat obscure or not really that clear when it comes to money supply, money printing, and the excess money. You know, we keep hearing about this, so the first question is, what is the theory behind it? But more importantly, where did the money go? I mean, you know, we're talking about a lot of money here that was pumped out by the central banks, correct?
Indeed. There was an article I wrote in an investment magazine, I think it was in 2018, where I showed a graph showing central bank, primarily the Fed and the ECB, and I think there may have been the Bank of England. And if you track the trajectory of the S&P 500, so it's an investment index of one of the main board indices of the American stock market, you could actually track that when the market weakened off, the central banks would intervene and create more money. And the mechanism that they used was primarily by basically taking bad debt off the commercial banks' books and basically just issuing more debt. And I don't know if you've seen more recently than in Japan, for example, they've actually gone to another stage of money creation, which is probably going to blow up in their face. So is central banks
around
the world...
What stage is that? What kind of program are you referring to with Japan that you mentioned there?
Well, it's something I've not looked into more recently. It was reported on UK column yesterday by David Scott that the Bank of Japan, not only have they increased their main base rate from 0.25 to 0.50, but they've undertaken a further buying program of government bonds. So they issue new government bonds and they take them on their own books. So it's just monetizing the debt. You ask where the money goes. The money up until quite recently, until this inflation in the real economy started, has been going into asset prices, which is why we've seen stock markets, property prices, and all sorts of investments actually achieve record highs. What has happened, obviously, in the so-called COVID period, which is a whole other debate, basically they collapsed the real economy, so it wouldn't, all this money printing wouldn't actually appear in the real economy. Now that the COVID story has, if you like, rolled back because people are less amenable to being sort of intimidated into closing down their economic activity, there is now obviously activity, and we're seeing it creeping in on food prices, energy prices, etc. And let's not forget, along with this climate nonsense, they're also trying to destroy food production, particularly in Holland, where there has been a policy to actually stop people farming. And that is not exclusive to Holland. It's been a general trend across
Western...
Why
would they do that?
That's a very big question that has an answer. But essentially, we've been at war since 2001, and this is a war of the structure, which is those that believe that they can control the world centrally. They believe that there are too many of us on the planet, 7.8 billion or whatever the latest figure is. So they're looking to reduce the population and at the same time exercise control. And if you control food, then you control populations. I'm afraid that these sorts of ideas you will never see in a mainstream narrative because they just seem too fantastical. But when you look at the work, the research that we've been involved in, this is a collaborative research project looking out from many different perspectives, shows that this is undoubtedly agenda. That's what COVID was about. That's what climate change is about. And this is what the, if you like, the destruction and the so-called greening of the planet is about, is to destroy farming and food production. And I'm not saying that agribusinesses or industrial-scale farming should be protected, because there are better ways of doing things. But this is all about centralizing control, centralizing production, and reducing everybody's footprint, which effectively means that the carbon they are trying to reduce is the carbon life form, which is human beings.
Well, when you talk about the food, I'm looking down at what I have on food for to propose a question to you for. And I'm looking at food insecurity, where it's projected to reach a new peak, which was last experienced in 2007, 2008. And it cites a combination of factors, and it says the supply chain disruptions, COVID-19 pandemic, the war in Ukraine, rising inflation and high commodity prices. But the narrative that you just spelled out is somewhat different. It may contain that, but it's somewhat different. Clive, you're going into the fact that you are saying overall that you want, that you're saying that this is going to be centrally controlled in terms of, for example, food, and therefore there is a push for the population to decrease as a result of the way that food supply is controlled. If I understood you correctly, is that accurate?
Yeah, in small part, I think the two go together. There is a general. You only have to look across the world, more in the West than anywhere else, that they're actually reducing production of food. And one of the points that we made back in May, when this sanctions regime started against Russia because of what's going on in Ukraine, the sanctions were bound to be self-destructive because Europe is heavily dependent on imports for food. And Russia has plenty of energy and it has plenty of food. So there is a concerted effort. There are certain areas of the states where you can actually be prosecuted for growing your own food. There are stories of people being arrested for feeding the hungry. I mean, these are small indicators of something much bigger. But this is all coordinated, because if you look through every government, whether you're talking about Canada, New Zealand, Australia, countries across Europe, they're all adopting the same policies. Now, is it coincidence or is it planned? And our analysis would suggest that most of this is run by the those that control the money system, i.e. those that control the central banks and the large commercial banks. Uh-huh. And there is a concerted plan which brings together a lot of strands of what we've been talking about in terms of economic collapse, in order to and create disruption, in order to reorder the world. I think there's a Latin phrase which escapes me at the moment, but it essentially means order out of chaos, and that is the strategy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let me see. Let me introduce our guest, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Brussels. Welcome. You've walked into. If I was walking into this conversation, I wouldn't know where to start. But Elijah Magnier, I'll start with one of the statements that, amongst many bleak predictions for the world for the year 2023, this one I'm going to hit you with is from the IMF. 1/3 of the world economy expected to be in a recession, and it says it's because of the three big economies: U.S., EU, and China. And the bleak part of that, not that any of it was positive, says that half of EU is going to be in a recession. Elijah Magnier, what are we looking at when we're seeing all these bleak assessments that have been made? I'm sure you've read some of them, like this one from the IMF.
We are looking at the general recession that will hit the world, not only Europe or few part of the world, because the deterioration per capita income growth will be slower even in rich country, and that is due to several factors. Mainly, above all, is COVID, where the whole world was blocked for a very long time, and we were already told that we're going to be hit by an inflation. And secondly, are the U.S. measures against countries like Venezuela, Iran, and Russia to start imposing sanctions and prevent the flow of oil and energy that can contribute to bring down the prices, because everything follows the price of the oil. We have seen in March when the petrol reached $120 and today is around 80, when budget around the world in rich oil country producers is set up between $40 to $50 a barrel. So if we bring that down already and we lift all these sanctions, that is the best hobby of the U.S. to break the will of the population and impoverish the population. We have seen now that the U.S. has adopted another policy, pushing the EU to commit suicide by imposing sanctions that have a devastating boomerang effect. And we in Europe are suffering greatly. We pay the bill of gas and electricity. I used to pay 70 euros per month. A few days ago, I paid 340, and I am one individual living in a small place. So we can imagine the effect of prices on everything else that is affected in the market, and we can't live.
So what do you mean when you say the U.S. is pursuing a boomerang effect type approach? Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, Russia sells the gas to Europe and to China and to other countries with 30% discount. Today, we're buying it at the price market plus 4 to 10% from Norway and from the U.S., but we're also buying it from Azerbaijan, from Algeria, but we're paying much more than the price that we used to pay. Moreover, Europe is not equipped to liquid gas that we are buying from the US and other places because we don't have these terminals. All the economy is based on that, and then we have to renew all the infrastructure. We don't have the money to do it, and that will cost a lot. And then we see many companies are closing their doors. And by closing the doors and seeing China that is buying the Russian gas at 30% discount of the Russian price, then the economy in Russia is going to be more attractive than the European industry because it's going to be much more expensive. The Chinese industry is going to be available at a very adequate price that we cannot afford because we're paying the price of energy much higher, and then we're paying also the price of food, the transport, everything else follows the price of the energy. So if the U.S. stop playing with this very dangerous game by imposing sanctions on countries, by now pushing Russia, pushing China to an arms race by signing deals with Taiwan, with Japan, by increasing the Japanese GDP of weapons and armament, the double, by the UK signing another deal with Japan today, all that give us an indication that the US are really insinuating to the Chinese, we're going to come after you through Taiwan, and that will create tension the market is not going to like at all. This is why there will be a panic again in the market, where there will be many areas of insecurity, and that will increase the inflation. Hence, the recession is going to hit us all.
Clive Menzies, tell us the role that the U.S. and the U.S. economy actually plays in this whole thing, because we know on the one hand, the U.S. financial system is integrated throughout the world in terms of how it can impact the flow of money, the dollar and its function. And, of course, what our guest there from Brussels was saying, the U.S. foreign policy approach is in terms of sanctions, for example, sanctioning countries like Russia, like China, and even Iran, and how this all emanates from the U.S. in some sense that perhaps affects the world economic growth. I mean, if that even makes sense for me to ask it that way.
Yes, I think it does. I mean, we've lived in a dollar world since the end of World War II, or Bretton Woods. And I think what's becoming increasingly obvious is that certainly in the last year or so, but probably for quite a long time before that, the dollar, its days are numbered. In addition, the U.S. has basically been leaning on most other countries because of its military might and the strength of the dollar. And that is less potent than it used to be. I mean, by population, I think in terms of numbers of people, when you take in India, China, and other countries, the majority of the global population are against what America is doing in Ukraine, for example. And if one looks at what is happening, what is clearly evident from the Ukraine conflict is that Russian military sophistication could possibly exceed that of the US. There is certainly problems in the UK military in terms of morale and political correctness has sort of crept in and reduced its effectiveness as a force. So I think this, we're witnessing a dying empire, but what we're seeing more than anything is plunder. So the Biden administration is heavily involved in the corruption. The Ukraine, even before March this year, had turned into some sort of gangster state where there's a lot of money laundering going on. You may be aware of the FTX debacle where this cryptocurrency outfit has been washing money through Ukraine back into the Democrat Party. Right. And we're seeing the end of plunder and, okay. And it's so obvious everywhere, but it's being led from the States.
Sure. Sorry to jump in here and cut you off, but I just want to give Elijah Magnier, and unfortunately we're out of time, the last question here. So Elijah Magnier, when you take a look at countries that have the energy, i.e. oil and gas, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, We're looking at countries that are not pro-U.S., obviously, because these are being sanctioned. How much of a factor will that play in if they were to unite against the U.S. in terms of trying to regain that whole idea of globalization and not have what the world is experiencing now, which is this high energy prices, and therefore there to be a balance? But, of course, the U.S. would be left out. Under a minute, if you can.
Well, what the Americans are doing is allowing Venezuela to produce between 200,000 to 400,000 barrels of oil per day, enough for Venezuela to survive and for the Americans to take what they need because they import 700,000 from Russia. So they find alternative, but not enough for Venezuela to survive. If the U.S. stop playing this game, because at the end of the day, the U.S. is indebted to $33 trillion, but it is in dollars. They can print it any time, okay, and they don't care, really. So sure, at the end of the day, their devastating policy and destructive okay policy is one of the major causes of what's happening in the world.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're just fresh out of time. But thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, Clive Menzies, as a pleasure, researcher and political economy analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tahoe and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Leaders meeting with women active in science, society, and culture. On Wednesday, 4th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a group of women noted for their activities in science, culture and society at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Wednesday, 4th of January, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a large gathering of prominent Iranian women, all of them active in science, culture, and society. The meeting follows a request last year by a group of women for an exclusive meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Many topics were discussed at this meeting, among them giving expert and academic women a bigger role in policy-making and decision-making at all levels, including the highest levels of the government. The leader emphasized that a way should be found to make this happen. Another topic of discussion was the difference between the status of women in Islam and in Western societies. The leader poignantly added, "Modern Western society has commented on virtually every aspect of life during the past 200 years. But with regards to women, Westerners have mistreated women, exploited women, treated them as sexual objects, committed crimes against women, and are certainly guilty." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about Islam's viewpoint with regard to gender and the issue of women. He said, "Regarding the Islamic viewpoint, it can be said that Islam sees individuals as human beings. Men and women have no priority over each other, and they are both human beings. They're not different in this. The equality of men and women in terms of human and Islamic values is one of the clear principles of Islam. There is no doubt about this." The leader recited Ayah 35 of Surah Ahzab in the Holy Quran that states, "Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the faithful men and the faithful women, the obedient men and the obedient women, the truthful men and the truthful women, the patient men and the patient women, the humble men and the humble women, the charitable men and the charitable women, the men who fast and the women who fast, the men who guard their chastity and the women who guard their chastity, the men who remember Allah greatly and the women who remember Allah greatly. Allah holds in store for them forgiveness and a great reward." The leader emphasized that there is no difference between men and women in terms of human and Islamic values. Islam regards men and women as human beings. Neither one is more favored than the other. Turning to the duties of men and women, which are different, the leader said there is a balance in this regard. He added, "There is a holy law mentioned in the Holy Quran in Ayah 228 of Surah Baqarah, where the Almighty says, 'And women also have rights similar to those of men over them, in accordance with Islamic law. Women have the same number of rights over men as men have rights over women. When a duty is assigned to someone, they have a right in return for it. For every privilege there is given to either side, there is a responsibility. Thus, there is a complete balance. That is about the rights of men and women. Therefore, they do not have the same rights and duties, but it is balanced. When we look at responsibilities, emphasis is placed on the natural characteristics of men and women. There are certain differences between men and women, that is, in the female nature and in the male nature. There are both physical and spiritual differences between men and women. Their duties are in accordance with these differences. These differences have an effect on the type of responsibilities assigned to men and women. This has to do with a feminine and a masculine nature." Turning to the status of women in the modern capitalist West, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that Western capitalism is a patriarchal system. He pointedly added, "What they attribute to Islam, which is incorrect and is the opposite of the truth, exists in their own capitalist system." This viewpoint stems from the fact that in capitalism, capital, that is money or wealth, is more important than humanity. Humans serve capitalism by generating wealth. Whoever is able to generate and accumulate more wealth, that is, more capital, has a higher status in the capitalist system. The leader stressed further, "Generally, it is men who manage Western economies, and big businesses are run by men. Therefore, men have priority over women in capitalism. Since capital is more in the hands of men, men have a higher priority. So, in the Western system, capital determines the status of people, and people are no longer the same. Different amounts of wealth for each individual gives them different status." Turning to how women are abused in the capitalist West, Ayatollah Khamenei pointed to two ways in which women are abused. He added, "One is in the workplace itself. This is an important point. In many Western countries right now, women receive lower wages than men for the same type of work when they perform similar work. Also, in the 19th century, Western women were encouraged to leave their homes and to work in factories where they received much lower wages than men." Commenting on the US Civil War, the leader said, "The same thing happened with regards to the freedom of black people in America during the American Civil War in 1860. That is almost 160 years ago. Over 1 million people were killed in this Civil War. During the Civil War, the issue of freedom of black slaves was raised. Southern United States was mostly agricultural, whereas Northern United States was industrialized. The African American or the black slaves were mostly in the South, where they were used for farming. The people in the North needed cheap labor. They needed these black people, the African Americans. The controversy over freeing the slaves was initiated by the people in Northern United States. Factories in the North needed cheap labor, cheap workers, so black slaves in Southern United States were freed to work as cheap labor in Northern U.S. factories. It is the same method of deception used by the civilized gentleman in the West when dealing with various issues. There are many other such examples." Commenting on the second way in which Western women are abused, the leader said, "Western women are exploited and used to provide pleasure to men. It is actually very difficult for me to talk about this subject in any gathering, but especially in a gathering with women. But this is the reality. What can we do? They did everything they could to convince women that their value and worth was dependent on their behavior in trying to make themselves more sexually attractive to men. They did everything they could. It is a very sad story." The leader added, "I have read many things in this regard. It is very difficult to talk about this. In one American magazine, which was shown to me around 7, 8, or 10 years ago, a very famous American businessman who owned a chain of restaurants announced that he was hiring people. But what type of people? He was hiring young girls and young women under the conditions which were written down in their contract. One of these conditions was that the length of their dress or the length of their skirt needed to be a certain amount above their knees. They had even published a photograph of how the women should look like serving in these restaurants." Turning to the West's shamelessness and brazenness, the leader poignantly remarked, "With all the harm and all that they have inflicted upon women, to a woman's dignity and her honor, they pretend to be the flag bearers of women's rights. That is, Westerners are misusing the case of women's rights in the world for their own intentions. This is truly the ultimate shamelessness by the West. Despite all that, they still say they support women and are in favor of women's rights. This is what is called women's freedom in the impious language of the West. When they say women's freedom, what they really mean is this type of freedom. These things are freedom in their opinion. But in actual fact, this is not freedom. This is slavery. They are insulting women. Commenting on homosexuality in the West, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The legalization of things such as homosexuality in the West, which is forbidden in all divine religions. Talk about homosexuality being forbidden and things like that is not just something found in Islam. These are major sins in all religions. They legalize these, and they really do not even feel ashamed about it. Therefore, one of the actions that is obligatory in our society is that we must strictly avoid the Western viewpoint on issues such as gender and sexuality." Commenting further, the leader said, "Praise God. Learned, wise, intelligent, educated women like yourselves exist everywhere. And this group, which is sitting here today, is a sample of the population. You are a flower from a great floral garden. Praise God, we have a large number of discerning, judicious, educated, well-informed women throughout this country." The leader went on to talk about issues of women's role in the subject of family. The leader asked, "So what is a woman's role in the family environment?" He added, "Just as you would not be able to breathe if there was no air in the environment, that is how it would be if there was no woman in your family unit. The woman in the family unit is like fresh air that is breathed in that environment. So a woman sometimes assumes the role of a wife in the family, and at other times she assumes the role of a mother. There are certain attributes for each role. In the role of a wife, a woman is primarily a manifestation of calm, as it says in the Holy Quran, and made from its mate that he might find comfort with her. She's a source of calm because life has its ups and downs. In this sea of life, a man is busy with work and the turbulence. When he comes home, he needs calm. He needs comfort. This comfort is created by the woman of the house. A woman is a source of tranquility, love, and serenity. A woman's role as a wife is to provide love and serenity." Further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution went on to talk about Islamic hijab. He said, "I would also like to add that in recent events, you saw how they worked against hijab and such things. Who were the ones who stood up to these efforts and incitements? The women themselves. The women stood up to them. The enemies had pinned their hopes on these women, who you say are wearing a bad form of hijab. They had pinned their hopes on them. They were hoping that these women would have incomplete hijab, would remove it completely. But they didn't. They slammed those propagandists and instigators in the West." The leader added, "The final thing that I would like to mention is that women have made great progress in the Islamic Republic of Iran in such fields as academia, universities, medicine, cutting-edge technologies, sports, etc." The leader also wished all Iranian women prosperity and success.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.